If you want to be at the tip of the spear of sports performance, the answer is simple. Simply Faster is your insider's edge to maximize results with the highest quality premier sports equipment in the business. Visit Simply Faster and level up. Welcome, everyone, to the Companions of the Compendium podcast. I have an absolute special guest today, Dr. Ken Clark. For those of you that don't know who Dr. Ken Clark is, he's an associate professor in the Department of Kinesiology at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. Ken's research focuses on the underlying mechanical factors in athletic performance and injury. Ken teaches biomechanics and kinetic anatomy at the undergraduate level and also teaches motor learning for both undergraduate and graduate level. Ken played college football and has more than a decade of hands-on coaching experience, including working with teams and athletes at high school, collegiate, amateur, and professional levels. Everybody, I'm pleased to have Ken on. And one of the things I love about Ken, and we're going to get into it a little bit more as we talk here, is the fact that he's a guy that's a sports scientist, in my opinion, that gets it. And so you guys are going to enjoy this because he's a person that can bring those 30,000 foot discussions down to a level that idiots like myself can understand perfectly and greatly. So Ken, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to, you know, having a great conversation about some really interesting topics and just an honor to be on the podcast and we should have some fun.
Well, as a frustrated jock like myself, what was the things that you had in your experience growing up as an athlete and in sports that led you down this path of interest in the hard sciences of kinesiology and motor learning and things like that, that led you down this direction for your career as a person to become an expert in this field?
I, like a lot of people in this field, was just not as good an athlete as I wanted to be. And I think that naturally led to it. So, as I'm fond of telling, I was not genetically gifted, but I came from an athletic family. I have a great family. There's a huge emphasis on athletics in my family. Both my mom and dad played college sports. My dad had played college football. He was a high school football coach who did speed training with his athletes. I was always trying to get faster. As my common joke goes, I'm short and I'm weak, but I made up for it by being slow. So I was always trying to get better, just to even, you know, be able to start in high school or play at the Division III level. And actually, I was doing speed training and some pretty progressive stuff with my dad as early as the age of 8. So my dad went down, paid his own way to the Voluntary Tennis Academy when some of the, you know, early big names in speed training were putting together some of these foundational ideas in like the late 80s. And I was doing things like plyometrics and overspeed. I kid you not, like bungee cord pulling overspeed when I was like 9 years old, whether that was good or not. But so I had an interest in this, you know, from a really young age, just in my own athletic career. And it allowed me to play high school and Division III sports, you know, and probably without that type of training, I would have not even been able to have start, you know, high school football or baseball, or even to have played football at the Division III level, even at a small school. So I was always I felt indebted to the mechanisms that allowed an athlete to get better, but also at the same time, you know, just always thinking that as great as the training that I did with my dad was, you know, that there's got to be a better way. And then when I got into coaching myself in my young 20s and mid 20s, frankly, feeling frustrated with not feeling like I was giving as good training regimens as I could, that there had to be more knowledge leading to better programming, leading to better outcomes with my athletes. So that's really what drove it. And, you know, lo and behold, it you know, from hobby as an athlete to passion as a coach to career, frankly, with what I do now, I couldn't have necessarily predicted that this is how it was going to turn out, but it's really been great. I mean, for the last 15 years, I've basically been obsessed with all things speed. That's all I think about. That's all that's all I care about. And it leads to a really happy kind of hybrid existence in my professional life, teaching, researching and coaching. So that's how I got to where I'm at, for better or worse. So
with your father, did that training pay dividends right away as he was starting to implement that stuff, being a coach?
Great question. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say because this is back in the day and age of, you know, hand timing and a lot of other things that aren't as, you know, perhaps rigorous even in the coaching world as they are now. But, you know, all I can say is this, I know that whatever level of athleticism I attained at the high school and college level, and I'm not bragging here at all, it wasn't much, but whatever I attained would have been way less had I not done that training, that's for sure. And so I always felt, I guess, that performance training had a big outcome on my life. I mean, to just even to play sports in high school or at the small college level versus not being able to, I mean, that had a big effect on my self-esteem, the relationships I was able to build with teammates, and just an overall huge positive outcome and effect on who I was as a, you know, 18, 22 year old kid and who I am now. And so part of the reason I, you know, and I think this is true for everybody who gets into coaching, but part of the reason I love coaching is that, you know, you just want to pay that forward and you just want to be able to pass along, you know, not the same knowledge, because obviously things changed from 20 years ago, but in a similar manner to pass on knowledge and help, you know, young student athletes develop both as athletes and as human beings. And same thing from the research side of things, kind of that genuine curiosity as to, well, is there a better way? And you know, what leads some people to be fast and others to be slow is the simple question that's driven my entire professional life. But yeah, just, you know, further investigations into those questions and then the practical applications of that has really been, you know, kind of a huge motivation for me for the last 10 to 15 years. So.
Well, I find you to be endlessly curious, which I think is what makes you such a great coach and research scientist simultaneously and a doctor in the field of kinesiology. And I think that's one of the reasons why so many people in the track and field world love you so much, is because the measurements that we're trying to achieve and gain are so very small that, you know, you have to be dialed in, right? You know, you can't be the old guy with the real slow trigger finger, you know, on the start of the 40 and be like, oh, well, you know, you ran, I think a 4.6 or something like that. Now, you did mention, however, with this conversation, that there were some things that maybe you felt like there could be a better way or there's got to be more to this. So when you started that kind of rooting of this curiosity, what was the first avenues that you started to explore to try to get your fix in terms of your thirst for knowledge?
Yeah, absolutely. So it actually started with my master's thesis. Well, I was at Westchester University. You know, I had actually been a psychology as an undergrad at Swarthmore College because they didn't have exercise science. And after coaching for a little bit, I realized I needed to get a degree in the field. So I went to Westchester, where I now teach. But I went there as a student when I was in my late 20s to get a master's in kinesiology. And my thesis for that was on actually resisted sprint training. And so it was a simple question as, I did this as an athlete, but never, you know, I just did that as an athlete because that's what, you know, we did, because that's what we were told to do, without an actual kind of formal analysis of what, you know, we were doing was working. And so it, you know, it did arise organically from genuine curiosity as to, hey, does this actually work? And if not, is there a better way to do it? And of course, as we all know now, resistant sprint training is all the rage for acceleration these days. I actually looked at a different part of sprinting at top speed, resistant sprinting for top speed. And it just came out of literally the question of, well, I did this as an athlete, but without any knowledge of whether or not this actually worked. So can I conduct an experiment to determine whether or not this actually works in Division III team sport athletes who are just like myself? We did it with the nearby Haverford College lacrosse team with their guys who are, you know, quite similar to the, you know, the athlete that I had been a decade before. So yeah, I think it all comes back to, like you said, you know, just kind of having, asking good questions. You know, I want to throw a shout out to where I did my doctoral research, the SMU Locomotive Performance Lab with Dr. Peter Warren, Dr. Larry Ryan. I mean, that was always impressed upon me that everything from the research standpoint comes with asking good questions. And, you know, that's where good research and good research studies and impactful findings come from. It all comes back to the question, but really that's no different than coaching, right? I mean, every good coach out there questions what they do on an annual basis and looks at their training plan from last year and said, does that get the as good results as it could? And you know, gives that a critical eye. So Back to your original question, and sorry if this has been a long-winded answer, but my original interest in kind of the scientific aspect of the field came back to, well, I did these things as an athlete, but didn't really know quantifiably if they worked. And then as a young coach, from the age of 24 to 28 or 29, my first 5 years in the field, I was doing a lot of things. They weren't bad, but I don't know how good they were. You know, did they really work from a quantitative standpoint? You know, if I look hard in the mirror, I'd say, I don't know. So that's kind of where a lot of the, you know, I guess the interest in a little bit more of a research bent on things came. You know, one final talking point, you know, and I know we're going to get into this later. I see the lines between great coaching and sports science / research really blurring in this day and age, and in a good way. Blending is probably a better way to describe it. I mean, if you're collecting data on your athletes as a performance coach, as a track coach, strength and conditioning coach, I mean, you are doing research of sorts. It may be field research with field data, but if you're analyzing that data and then making adjustments, well, you're hypothesizing on what works best, observing the results, you know, coming up with some conclusions and then re-going through the whole scientific process. So I do think that, you know, there's a real blending of the field that's currently happening and that will probably continue to happen. And I think if that's done correctly, that's a really good thing. I think if it's done incorrectly, it's a bad thing, but done correctly, that can be a really good thing.
So when we talk about doing things incorrectly, where do we see people make mistakes and how do we avoid those?
One thing that I feel really strongly about, and again, I don't want to jump too far ahead in our discussion pointers here, but sometimes it's challenging to take findings from a research study, for example, and then know how to apply that to the athletes that are in your population. Even the best research studies, to a large degree, the findings, the data, the conclusions from that research study are going to be specific to the population that that was conducted with. Maybe it transfers to a broader population, but maybe it doesn't. And I think that one thing that sometimes is overlooked or one thing that can be done, you know, incorrectly, to put it, I guess, a little bit on the harsh side of things is, you know, making an assumption that just because this training program worked for X group, you know, that it's going to work for my group that is not like the group in which the research study was done. And that works both ways. You look at a training study that was done in like an elite group and try to transfer that on to, you know, down to a youth or a recreationally trained group. A lot of research, especially older research, was done with recreationally trained university students because that's what faculty members have access to, is they're, you know, they're phys ed students. But just because you get a finding in a group, you know, a heterogeneous group of recreationally trained phys ed students, doesn't mean it's going to translate to a highly highly trained group of elite sprinters, right? So trying to have a good understanding of, you know, how to read research and then know, you know, the proper ways to translate that to the group that you're training, I think is key. And sometimes when mistakes happen, I think it's just because findings are taken out of context. You could make the same exact analogy to some of the social media issues we have going on, which is people with good intentions, you know, put just clips of their training group out, and then people who train another population look at that and say, oh, that's cool. You know, I need to be doing that with my athletes. And again, it works both ways. And that's nobody's fault, but it works both ways. If you're training a seventh grader who's, you know, still very developmental and needs to hit the big rocks first, it's probably not in your best interest to look at what an Olympian or an NFL player is doing and necessarily think that whatever that person's doing is good for your seventh grader. So I think that taking things out of context is potentially, you know, a pitfall that just needs to be watched out for. So
on the opposite side of the coin with that, then, how do we best, as coaches, marry the sports science with our coaching? What could you suggest to coaches out there would be the best way for them to use this blood, sweat, and tears of research and understanding and data and information and best marry it to their practices, to their training system, and adapt it within their program?
Great question. I mean, to a large degree, that's a million-dollar question between sports science coaches and you know, having research and application marry up for the mutual benefit of all. So I always think it's important that, you know, coaches don't jump on any one particular study per se, but rather see where the trend of the research is going. So I'm going to, I'll use a particular example of resistance sprint training, because that's something that applies to speed. And, you know, I think it's, you know, kind of really in vogue and a popular topic of discussion lately now. So if you just read one research study that has some finding, you know, there's the chance that that research study was done with a population that's not the same as yours, or under conditions that aren't the same as yours, et cetera. And so there's a little bit of a risk that perhaps the finding from that study aren't, you know, necessarily applicable to your group. But the nice thing about science is that it is iterative and it self-corrects. So if there's a study that finds one thing, several other studies may try to repeat it, or try to repeat it in a slightly different population. And all those different studies could be correct. But, you know, if one study finds one thing and then three others find the opposite, well, that generally starts to self-correct it, so that if you look at the trend of where the evidence is, you can start to pull out some good conclusions. I think there's a little bit of danger in looking at any one or two studies in particular, but you can look at what I would term a growing body of evidence to suggest doing this. So let's take resisted sprint training, for example. You know, if you latch on to one study, you know, early on, perhaps that was doing no more than 10% of body mass. And by the way, my master's thesis did that for top speed sprinting. So I'm not throwing stones at that old 10% rule. But, you know, if you look at it, you know, one study that you know, had a certain findings, maybe you would say that, well, resisted sprint training isn't that useful. Lately, there's this growing body of evidence. J.B. Marin's group, Matt Cross, Johan Lahti, Michal Cahill, a bunch of different studies in a bunch of different populations, team sport athletes, sprinters, male high school athletes, et cetera, that are finding basically the same thing, which is that, hey, heavy resisted sprint training improves initial acceleration. So you can start to have a pretty good degree of confidence once you see that growing body of evidence that, okay, this is probably something that I want to investigate using with my athletes. So to me, that's how sports science and application blends best, is it just perhaps takes a tiny bit of patience and persistence to, you know, read over not just one and hang your hat on that one study, but several studies that have looked at a given training protocol or a given mechanistic finding in several different populations under several different conditions, and say, yeah, okay, there's a growing body of evidence that this protocol works, and then you can have confidence in that. So just to tie a bow on it, with resisted sprint training, I mean, again, you look across the research from JB, Johan, Matt Cross, Michal Cahill, others, you're like, okay, well, this, you know, this works in the following populations, generally doing relatively the same protocol. We've seen some improvements in competitive sprinters. We've seen it in professional soccer players, Johan's athletes. We've seen it in some team sport athletes like rugby players, and we've seen it in male high school team sport athletes with Michal's research. I would say that's a pretty effective method of training when you have 4, 5, 6, 7 training studies that are now showing some evidence of this. So from my perspective, that's the best way to approach it. And research isn't always clean cut. Sometimes it's messy, where 3 studies will find one thing and 4 studies will find another, and it gets a little hard to tease out. But I think that's the way to approach it.
When we're teaching people how to consume these documents and we're looking at the abstract, which is oftentimes where noobs like me will go to try to figure out, okay, what is the baseline stats, information, data, or suggestions that I'm getting from this? How do we go beyond that abstract? Would you suggest that coaches like me that are trying to allow like Google Scholar to guide us a little bit, would we be looking more for a meta-analysis versus just a single abstract? Talk about what would be a strategy for us specifically to do what you're saying to do.
Yeah, I mean, review papers or meta-analyses can be, you know, a good place to start if you can find one of those on the given topic that you're interested in. Those don't always exist. But it's not a bad way of doing it. And it's as much about whatever that review paper or meta-analysis says itself, but also just that in the references section, that will give you, you know, other good places to look, basically. That, you know, the references section is your roadmap to then go and read those studies as well, because meta-analyses and review papers don't always get it right all of the time. It's good to double check them, if you will. But yeah, that's a good starting place. And, you know, you can always just basically go to Google Scholar and work your way backwards chronologically, because a lot of times the most recent articles, if they're doing a good job of citing prior work, they're going to have listed all of the articles that preceded them chronologically, at least the relevant ones. And so that can give you a pretty good roadmap. I know when I was, you know, in my kind of formative years as a performance coach, from when I was about 24 to 29, I was working in a private sector facility, and our because we were private sector, our timeline was a little screwy, our hourly schedule. I would work from 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. and I would just go home and read one article a night. I was just kind of in that massive consumption of knowledge phase, and I'd get home at 9:30, and I would just, before I went to bed, it was just one article every night. But as we know, I mean, that just starts to add up. And of course, I was only interested in speed. So at the end of the year, I mean, 365 speed articles, and you've developed a pretty good working knowledge of what's out there. But I kind of went through it exactly like we're discussing now. I would read an article, and then, you know, if that was on a certain topic, I'd take some notes on it, and I'd go to the references section, and then I would go find the other articles that it had referenced. And pretty soon you get feel of what is the body of evidence tell you, you know, not as what does one paper tell you, but what is the, you know, what's the trend in the scientific research. So that's, you know, I think that's one good way to approach it. I'll also say, you know, I think that it is really important that people read entire papers and not just abstracts. And I know that it's challenging because we're all crunched for time, but I think a lot of the devil is in the details, and it's the Twitter analogy. Sometimes, you know, the true story can't be told in 140 characters, if you will. And so the difference between good and bad research sometimes gets lost if you only read the abstract or, you know, first paragraph of the intro and last, you know, the last paragraph of the summary and conclusion. So I definitely strongly encourage people who are consuming the research to try to carve out the time to read the whole thing through. You know, as far as methods goes and understanding whether research is sound methodologically, I mean, I think that even people who, you know, don't have an advanced degree probably have a better sense of what good methods are than they might know. I mean, coaches at their heart set up training studies all the time. That is your cycle. That's your 12-week cycle. And you, I mean, coaches know how to design a training program that's going to work. So, you know, even in these 12-week training studies, you can see if this has kind of construct validity, ecological validity. Well, is this something that I would do and try to get some results? So
in that 365-day research deep dive on speed, what was the Dr. Ken's mental neural analysis that came from all that research? What were some things that popped out as a meta-analysis from your own personal deep dive that you kind of discovered through that process?
Gosh, that's a great question. And yeah, I think this is one of those things where I'm just going to have to say, I don't know. It just led to more questions. So it was really just, I was just trying to cover as much ground as I could. And I was, of course, really into the formative studies by Peter Weyand and some of his colleagues. And that ultimately led me to go down there and do a PhD, but just kind of some of the other classic research on running mechanics that was out there. And yeah, it really just led me kind of down the road of this. This is what's known, and then this is what's not known. So when it led me to ask more questions, it really was more of just, I guess you could say, surveying the scene and figuring out what had already been studied, but what wasn't known. Because that's really what was more interesting to me. It wasn't just like, okay, well, what do we already know? But it's like, well, what other questions are there still to ask? Because as somebody who was just like starting to wrap his head around the fact that, hey, maybe this research thing is cool. Like that's where my mind really was, which is, well, there's all these studies out there and yet we still don't know this, or this still doesn't make sense to me. So probably the coolest, most eye-popping thing in all that was just still what I realized, you know, remained to be explored. And that was back in 2009. at that, you know, I was doing that 2008, 2009. So I think that was the coolest thing. And without getting too macro level philosophical, I mean, there's still so much we don't know at this point, just about running mechanics on its most base level, but also proper training protocols and really what works for getting people faster, you know, and the different phases of sprints and different types of athletes, et cetera. I mean, we still have, there's so much we don't know. There's still a long way to go. And I view that as a beautiful thing. It's boring if you know all the answers. So
what is not boring that is curious for you that you are interested in right now and you're looking to explore further?
Yeah, I think
in your future research.
Yeah, training protocols for top speed, experimental evidence as to what gets people better for top speed, not just their performance, but also their mechanics is definitely number one. You know, I think that there's more research on that in acceleration, especially within the last decade that's exploded. I think number one is because, you know, everybody feels like acceleration relates to them, you know, track and field or team sport athlete, you name it. I think that there's perhaps a degree, well, I'm going to say this a different way. People are less hesitant to do acceleration-based studies. They don't feel like they're putting their athletes at risk for a soft tissue strain or anything like that. I'm not sure that should necessarily be a concern, but I think there's that thought out there. So there's more research, I think, on acceleration training protocols, not on acceleration mechanics per se, not on like what are the basic biomechanics of acceleration or what makes fast people fast. There's a lot of that on both top speed and acceleration, but on just pure training studies, longitudinal training protocols, there's more on acceleration. There's not nearly as much on top speed. There certainly exists, but I think more is needed. And so to me, that's like probably the number one thing I want to investigate, you know, moving forward from 2021 to 2026 or the next five-year cycle, if you will, is that area. I think at this point with top speed, we clearly know what we're looking for. I mean, I think there's a really firm understanding of the basic biomechanics that underlie speed. And you know, that's everything from Peter Wayne's research at Harvard and our research, you know, when I was lucky enough to be with Peter and Larry at SMU and at Ryu Nagahara's research and the Bezotis brothers. I mean, there's just so many great researchers that have looked at top speed mechanics. We understand, I think, what's going on there. But I think there's much less of an understanding of, well, I've got a football player, doesn't have great mechanics, and I need to get him better from 20 to 40 yards. You know, what should I do? Like, what is the exact X's and O's? What are the nuts and bolts of what I need to do when the rubber meets the road as a researcher and a coach to get him faster? So I think that's the number one area of interest I have moving forward. And of course, I guess you could all sadly tie this back to say that as an 18-year-old athlete working on my 40-yard dash, I was great from 0 to 20 and stunk from 20 to 40. So maybe that's just me still continuing for some answers there.
Well, I think that our experiences definitely drive a lot of our choices in terms of where we start to search for our answers, our research, where we try to find solutions for the things that maybe we were not given answers to. And it's no disrespect to our coaches or people who are in our life. I think it's just natural that, like for me, I had lots of hamstring injuries, right? And so I have a lot. And I was unable to ever get past the point of getting fit and getting fast. Like I could get one or the other and then I would get hurt. And so it's one of those things when I implement a lot of what I do in my training. So there's a big, you know, group of people out there that, you know, don't believe you really need to warm up. And some people would probably look at my stuff and go, my warm up maybe is too thorough or too deep or too long. But for me, it was a response to try to solve or fix that hamstring problem, because I don't want to be the reason why my athletes are unable to perform at a high level. And if they get hurt, I am the reason why they got hurt. That's hard to live with. And so I think it's very interesting when we look at some of this stuff where it drives us based on our experiences and where we want to explore. Now, speaking of high speed running, where are you sitting at with limb velocity What are some things that coaches, because Carl Valley wanted me to ask you this question.
I know. I saw that on Twitter that Carl was requesting.
And I thought that was since we're talking about high speed running and max velocity and absolute speed, what do we know and what can coaches apply based on that knowledge of limb velocity?
Another great question. And I know this one was prompted by Carl. So what do we know? Let's start with that. That's easier to answer. What do we know? This is going to, you know, relate back to some of my research at SMU and then our more recent research at Westchester. I'll also draw on some Ralph Mann research. So we know that faster runners apply greater vertical forces and shorter ground contact times at top speed. We know that the way that they're applying greater forces and shorter contact times primarily occurs in the first half of ground contact, that faster runners are applying more force in the first half of ground contact than slower runners. Competitive sprinter versus team sport athlete, the second half of ground contact is actually basically the same from a vertical force standpoint. Competitive sprinter may apply a little bit more horizontal propulsive force, but all of the differences in vertical force are in the first half of contact. From our two mass model and other research at SMU, that's coming from limb touchdown velocity. So the faster sprinters have a faster limb velocity at touchdown combined with a stiff ground contact. You know, you need to make sure that there's some optimal level of stiffness where you're not excessively yielding into the ground, but rather, you know, popping the ground. That is all triggered. And this comes back to our more recent research from Westchester from thigh rotational velocity, basically the angular velocity of the thigh throughout the gait cycle, good posture, good front side mechanics, you know, and then really being able to rotate the limb and create that high limb touchdown velocity, both down the foot vertical velocity at touchdown and backwards relative to the runner. So I'm not going to term that negative foot speed. I think that's the terminology is key here. I'm just going to term it the vertical velocity of the foot and the backward horizontal of the foot relative to the runner. It moves backwards relative to the runner's center of mass. Those foot touchdown velocities are crucial. Our research, you know, showed that the vertical foot touchdown velocity is highly related to the vertical force application and short contact times and faster top speeds. Some of Ralph Mann's research and some other data I have a part of as part of the USATF high performance program, we know that the horizontal foot velocities, horizontal backward foot touchdown velocities are also key. That's what we know. As far as improving that and what we can measure, you know, in the field on a daily basis, I think there's a lot of room for progress there moving forward. Just from a pure measurement and instrumentation standpoint, I would say we're at a little bit of a bottleneck there where that's not, you know, at least for most coaches in the field. I know maybe Carl has access to equipment that can measure this, but for most coaches who are in the field and not in a lab scenario, that's not something that's, you know, readily available. Even with our USATF high performance, you know, we get those measurements after the fact. That's not a metric that we can provide the coach and the athlete on the track. So although that's really, really important as far as instantaneous feedback that we can give an athlete or a coach or that an athlete can measure them, sorry, a coach can measure themselves, not available in most scenarios now. There's also limited research on how to improve that. So this is clearly a great research question that's sitting out there. I mean, one clearly that I have my eye on as well. But, okay, we know these variables are key. There just haven't been any studies or many studies, to my knowledge, that have actually looked at this before and after a given training program and said, okay, this variable's key. This is what we did to try to improve it. These are the results we got and improved it. And to me, that's a natural fit as far as, you know, where we need to go from a research standpoint. So I'm not sure if I exactly answered your question, but that's definitely what we know about limb touchdown velocities, where we need more information, and certainly where more research is needed as far as how to improve that is still to be determined. We need better measurement equipment, more readily available, hands-on, field-based ways of determining those metrics. And then, you know, along with that, we need some, frankly, just some more training studies that can establish protocols that are effective in improving those variables. So It's a great question.
So we may,
I knew when Carl asked that, that I was going to enjoy talking about that.
Yeah. Love it, man. It's so intriguing. It's so intriguing. And especially as we know, like the athletes that reach the highest velocities tend to be the fastest over the, you know, Olympic, you know, sprints and things like that. So there's a lot at play there. And then of course, when we think about American football or rugby and you talk about breakaway speed, like there's a lot of opportunities there that if we can manipulate that through certain interventions, coaching, training modalities. So what do we see that isn't working when we look at the less elite athletes? So if we're going to kind of reverse engineer it, what are problems that we see that are probably obvious issues that the athletes who are not doing those things have maybe built their own trap or unable to do that leads to them not being able to achieve those things?
Man, that is a great question and a great way of phrasing it. Have built their own trap. I love it. I like to take a top-down view when I'm looking at a runner. And actually, I'll start with a competitive sprinter and then work my way backwards. I'll reverse engineer my answer to your reverse engineered question. I tend to look basically posture and pelvis first. So, you know, at top speed, obviously competitive sprinters, mostly upright with their trunk, with their torso, pelvis is just key. Pelvis has to be relatively neutral. You know, if you get anterior tilt of the pelvis, excessive anterior tilt, it's going to have a bad cascade of events down the kinetic chain. So competitive sprinters, relatively upright torso, pelvis is neutral. They minimize the backside swing of the thigh after toe off. Essentially, as soon as the foot toes off the ground, that thigh starts to reverse and come forward, usually within about 20 milliseconds after ground contact, it starts coming forward. And then, you know, the majority of their thigh range of motion takes in place in front of the body. So this is just kind of your classic Ralph Mann, you know, front side mechanics. They get thigh lift, this competitive sprinters we're talking about, typically 70 to 80 degrees in front of the body. Of course, there's some individual variability there. And then from that high knee lift position, you know, aggressively striking the ground, that high thigh angular velocity, and that's what leads to those fast foot touchdown velocities, both down and back. And then, you know, you combine that with a stiff strike on the ball of the foot. And if you do all that, which is a lengthy checklist, but if you do all that, you're doing a lot right. And you're probably going to, you know, be running fast and also safe in a way that's going to, you know, from a qualitative sense, perhaps just, you know, minimize or reduce your risk of soft tissue injuries. I mean, that is an effective way to run from both a performance standpoint and an injury risk standpoint. If you basically take that and then you say, well, that's what a competitive sprinter does. You know, what does a team sport athlete or somebody who's just not as fast and doesn't have as good mechanics, how do they build their own trap? Well, they built that trap from the top down. So it typically starts from posture and pelvic position, posture and hips. It's, in my opinion, almost impossible to have, you know, a bad posture, you know, bad position of the trunk and a anteriorly rotated pelvis, like hip bones pointed down, for lack of a more specific term, right? And do other things right. If those two things are going wrong, then by definition, almost a lot of other things down the kinetic chain are going to be affected and not for the better. So a lot of times in team sport athletes, especially American football players, we see the chest way out, kind of leaning forward, the hips, the pelvis is anteriorly rotated, hips are rotated forward and down, leads to excessive backside mechanics. You're getting that long, loopy backside recovery. You cannot, in that case, get the thigh up in front of the body. It leads to casting out, foot striking out in front of the body, slow limb touchdown velocities, both vertical and horizontal. And it puts your hamstrings in a bad position because now you've struck the ground way out in front of you and you literally have to pull your center of mass over your foot. So that's the good versus the bad kind of in a nutshell. From a coaching standpoint, to make this short and sweet, and I always give credit to my friend and colleague, Jason Kilgore, who's the head track coach at Westchester. The first three rules of top speed are just posture, posture, posture. It's a joke and a corny one at that we use with our athletes. But if the posture is off and we say posture, you know, including posture and hips, if the trunk and the hips are off, nothing else is really gonna work well. And Jay and myself, we probably got that. We probably stole that cue from somebody else, I'm sure. But that's a good way to envision it. And so, you know, with team sport athletes, that's typically the first thing I look to correct, is really getting them a feel for, you know, hey, when I'm at top speed, I've got a one cue I'll use a lot with athletes that I've worked with a lot, is just up tall and in front, or tall and in front, just to, hey, they're here and not here. And, you know, that the motion of the limbs has got to be in front of the body as opposed to behind the body. So that's a nice way to kind of boil it down in a nutshell as to what we're looking for from a kind of a posture and front side mechanics, leg recovery standpoint. So
this sounds like that you've displayed a lot of, you've laid out a lot of truths in terms of what we see when we have people who are not moving efficiently, not able to provide the limb velocity they need to provide. Through that, we're also radically increasing the chances of injury. And I agree with you. Looking at the 3 hamstring pulls that I've had in my program in 10 years, you know, and I have about 70 girls in my program, so I feel pretty good about having only 3. We've run pretty fast as well. But what I've noticed with those 3 ladies is they have a real sharp Q angle. They tended to be a little bit overweight, and they tended to have small feet. And, you know, in the small feet thing, I feel like is you don't have that platform that allows you to make as much mistakes and cover them. You don't have the robustness because that platform isn't there for you to kind of shake it out within the foot.
That's a super interesting concept. I have to say, I've never thought about that before, and maybe I should. There is some research out there that I'm aware of. I need to go back and take a better look at it, that, you know, kind of looks at the specifics of the foot and, you know, some of the physiology of the foot. I've never actually thought about foot size per se and how that affects things. So congratulations, you've stumped me.
That's a great opportunity.
That's a great slash really interesting thought. I can't speak to that, having never really thought of that before. I can definitely say this. There is a certain extent to which, especially for developmental athletes, if they just don't have the basic, you know, strength to body mass ratio, that achieving some of those technical positions can be difficult. The technique, the motion leads to the force. To a certain extent, there's going to be, you know, some underlying strength thresholds that you need to meet to be able to reach those positions. The strength and how it relates to speed is probably an entirely different webinar / Zoom that we could do another, you know, hour or two on. So I'm not sure if we need to go down that road, but we can. But yeah, developmental athletes, I think it's a combination of, you know, making sure that they have the, you know, requisite strength to body mass ratios, but then also correcting what technique issues you have control over. There may be some genetic anthropometric issues that you don't have control over, like the Q angle or the foot size, et cetera. So,
yeah. And so some of these kids, amorphically, they're going to be a challenge, and we have to monitor them and we have to be on them all the time. And luckily enough, I had another young lady who was built like that, and we were able to get her through her entire high school career. I mean, now we didn't get her senior year because of COVID, but we were able to keep her uninjured. And I mean, I was on that stuff all the time, making sure that we were addressing that, because we didn't want her to slip into bad habits, because she didn't have the margin of error to be able to do that. I've also found, and I don't know if you found this too, pushers versus pullers. Do we see that we have more problems with athletes hitting those proper positions and limb velocities if they're more of a quad centric versus a hamstring centric, a pusher versus a puller?
A great question that I don't have an answer to as well. So that topic has been broached to me by a number of different people. I've gone down a mini little investigation of that with various groups trying to kind of tease some of that out. Don't have enough data at this point to kind of come up to have a formal answer for you. You know, I think there's definitely different types of runners. And I think that, you know, certainly athletes that may tend to really hang on the backside, for lack of a better word. Like, they're really kind of over pushing. I'm not really getting into the pushers versus pullers here, but athletes that are really trying to eke out every little bit of force on the backside and they're way extended back behind them, you know, that potentially is going to have a negative cascade of events and lead them to cast out on the front side and potentially put themselves in a bad position. So yeah, that's another great question. Another area of interest. You know, I think continuing on with just the line of questions that I have, you know, it kind of comes down to knowing what we want to see from a mechanical standpoint, but then what's the line between clearly having a technical model that we generally want our athletes to adhere to for top speed mechanics. Let's just take that because that's easy enough to talk about. We already said what our punch list is, but then what's the acceptable level of variation? What's the acceptable bandwidth that we can, you know, live with for a high school kid or a college kid or an athlete with this, you know, body type, that sort of thing. So whether you want to call it pushers or pullers or, you know, muscular or fascial or just, you know, athletes that we know are fast, but they're built, and then athletes that are more just wired, right? And then, you know, do we need to have, how much variation do we need to allow in their technical model for individual variability? That's a whole nother topic for a whole nother day, but I think that's just one other avenue that definitely needs to be explored for further individual variability or further individualization, I should say, of, you know, technical models when we're working with our athletes. So
not to entirely paint you into a corner on this then, but it sounds to me when I'm hearing you describe this is that you're not as concerned about the push-pull thing as opposed to seeing the punch list of appropriate mechanical positions that probably everyone should be within certain guardrails?
I guess that's a good way to phrase it. Yeah, I guess I've never traditionally evaluated it as pusher and puller. And there's coaches who are way better than me who do evaluate it that way. So I'm in no way saying that that's, you know, not a good lens to see it through. That's just not the lens that I typically evaluate it through. With that being said, there definitely are athletes who are built different ways, right? I mean, there's athletes who are fast, who are look like Christian Coleman, and there's athletes who are fast who look like Andre DeGrasse, right? And they're just, you know, they are just basically guys who are the same speed or close to it who look totally different. So I'm in no way denying that there's different builds of athletes and athletes who achieve basically the same speeds in different ways. I guess I'm just a little bit more simplistic, frankly, and just at least in the athletes that I work with, you know, at the small college and high school level, kind of stick to the basic punch list. I think maybe when you're working with, you know, true elites, that it gets more individualized than that. But yeah, I think what the latter part of what you said, you know, kind of just looking for key positions with certain amounts of, you know, guardrail. I love that term, right? With certain amount of bandwidth or variability or acceptable levels of variability or bandwidth is a really good way to phrase it. Yeah, I guess that's more how I would describe my lens for whatever it's worth. And again, I, you know, easily say that I you know, I'm proud of the collective hat I wear in both research, coaching and teaching. I am definitely not the best coach out there. So I defer to, you know, to other coaches who maybe have a more precise lens to view it through a, you know, a pusher puller model or whatever else. But I typically stick to kind of more that top-down approach that I described. So
when we're talking about that top-down approach and we're talking about the kind of the checklist, the punches in the box, all this type of stuff, in your research and in your time looking at these things and looking at limb velocity, looking at posture, what can we do as coaches? What is your suggestion for us to do as coaches to attack that in practice? So like, when should we do it? How frequently should we do it? And what should it maybe look like?
I mean, I think that, you know, it should be addressed in warm-up. I am a coach that, you know, believes in warm-up. And from my perspective, you need to warm your athletes up to, you know, for all the reasons that I think you've already previously mentioned, to reduce the risk of injury, help with their mental engagement, prepare them for the session you're about to execute. There's going to be opportunities in every warm-up to work on technique. As part of the warm-up process where you're just, you know, you're getting their core temperature, their muscles, their connective tissues ready to go. Well, as part of that, you know, there should be drills that at least introduce or include some aspect of technique. And this is me being Captain Obvious here. I don't think I'm certainly reinventing the wheel, but I just love the fundamentals. I mean, we're just doing a top speed day. Then after kind of the general, you know, ramp, raise your body temperature, activate, mobilize, potentiate. But as part of that, a march, a skip, a run, straight legged run, step overs or dribbles, you know, some straight legged bounce. I love finishing up a warm up with just what I would term technical buildups or technical flies, where you're doing, you know, 2 to 3 flying 20s, just 20 yard buildup and 20 yard fly, just focusing on one aspect of technique. We do that a lot with my team sport athletes, a little bit less with our track and field athletes. But to me, you can address it in the warm up, you know, just with the drills. And I think there's an argument, I guess you could say, in social media or whatever else, of the validity or usefulness of drills. That I'll be the first one to say, if all you ever do is drills, you won't get faster, right? I mean, if all you did was right. A march, straight leg run, and dribbles, and you never sprinted, well, you wouldn't get faster. I totally agree. But in my mind, they fit a purpose as far as you need to warm up anyways. It's a great opportunity to work on technique there. I think working on, you know, some technical flies to finish off the warm up right before you sprint at full speed or near full speed is another great opportunity. You know, when you're doing either top speed sprinting or near top speed sprinting, I think it depends there, because maybe you're giving your athlete feedback on their rep and mechanics, but maybe you just want them to run and just be able to clear their mind and know that you've already addressed technique, not just in this session, but in the 12 weeks or the 12 years that it preceded it. So if you're doing some timing in practice, you just let them go. And I'd say that the fourth place that we do it, especially at the collegiate level, but I also do it in the private sector, is athletes are visual learners. So we absolutely watch tape with our Westchester sprinters and, you know, film them during practice and then have film sessions. This year is a little bit weird because of the pandemic, et cetera, but we'll do classroom sessions where, you know, we're going through each athlete's mechanics on tape, and we're learning from each other, Coach Kilgore and myself, with my private athletes, same thing, you know, filming their top speed, whether it's during flies or 40 yard dashes, and, you know, going over it with them so that they can be students of the game, no different than a team sport athlete, no different than a football player watching film on a Saturday after a Friday night game. So I think that there's potentially those four different scenarios. Warm up, you know, you could call it the end of warm up with some technical flies. If you are going to do any during your max velocity session, feedback after the rep, and then, you know, some sort of augmented feedback, video-based feedback, you know, during a film session after the practice. So I think that's the ways in which, or the time at which, to intervene and provide feedback, address it.
So now for the spicy topic, since we're spending so much time talking about high speed, and we know that Mr. Resisted Acceleration. Recently, we've gotten into a juicy Twitter discussion about the value of this or that. You know, we love our binary arguments. So recently there's been this whole binary discussion about acceleration and max velocity. Where are you on that debate? What are your opinions and thoughts about what we can even take from this debate, and where should coaches be going in respect to the outcome of this debate?
Like you said, everything on social media seems to be binary. So max velocity. Well, you know, most of my research is on max velocity. I've been a part of Michal Cahill's research on resisted acceleration, although, you know, that was his doctoral work. So most of my research is on max velocity. Certainly, I'm a huge proponent of people training max velocity, not just track and field. I mean, that's obvious, but team sport athletes as well. I think there's tons of benefits for it. I guess I'll start with this. I do think that max velocity has any number of benefits, either for team sport or track and field. You know, number one, it's just a great training stimulus. And I'm probably like a broken record on this because I've said it so many times before and webinars, conferences, or podcasts, but it's, to my knowledge, the highest amount of force you can apply in the shortest ground contact time. When people sprint, they're on and off the ground, and you know, less than 0.1 seconds if you're good, less than 0.12 if you're not. 4 to 5 times body weight if you're any good. It's an incredibly high rate of loading. So great training stimulus. Number two, in team sports, you know, you don't reach top speed a lot, which many team sport athletes don't, but the plays when you do reach top speed are going to be the game-breaking plays. So you need to be able to run fast in team sport settings, even if you don't do it frequently. Number three, a growing body of evidence, I'll use that term again, that training at high speeds or top speeds can reduce the risk of soft tissue injury, can, you know, serve as a quote-unquote vaccine, provided the athlete has been taught how to run before you have them do it. And then mostly to the point of this Twitter binary argument, you know, clearly from a mathematical standpoint, I'll get into the practicalities of this in a minute. From a mathematical standpoint, top speed affects the entire acceleration profile. We typically think as 20 meters or 20 yards as being an acceleration race. If I put two guys on a starting line, ready, set, go, we raced them to 20 yards, you know, we would say that's a test of acceleration. But the point I like to make, again, pure math and theory for right now, those two guys could have identical initial acceleration, F naught or A naught for all of you force velocity guys out there. Those two guys could have identical F naught or A naught. And if one guy has a top speed of 10 meters per second and the other one has a top speed of 9.5 meters per second, the guy with the faster top speed will win that race to 20 meters by over 2 feet. So in team sports setting, that's a big deal. 20 meter sprints happen all the time on the football field, on a soccer pitch, whatever. Beating your opponent to the ball by 2 feet is a big deal. In this case, we're saying that, well, these are two guys who have identical initial acceleration, and yet the guy with the better top speed will win that 20-yard race, and that's a 20-yard race that we're calling acceleration. So I always make the argument that max speed affects the acceleration profile. There's been some recent debate on social media as to whether or not training that way will actually improve your acceleration profile. Like, whether if all you did was top speed training, whether or not that would affect the initial acceleration profile. I don't have any research to support that. It seems to me to do good top speed training, flies, you know, for example, let's take the fly 10, the athlete has to do a good acceleration leading up to that fly 10. We do fly 10s with our Westchester athletes all the time. I do them with my team sport athletes all the time. You have to accelerate well to get into good top speed mechanics and to run a good fly 10. So when you train top speed, you are training acceleration if you're doing it right. So to me, I've never really understood that argument of only doing top speed training. We're not dropping it onto a treadmill, you know, in a lab where you're literally only doing top speed training. In a practice, if you're training top speed, you are training acceleration. Joey G, I'm not going to butcher his last name on air, but the coach at Florida Atlantic has probably done the closest I know to this. I don't want to butcher his training protocol or his results. I'll only allude to it that people should go look that up for themselves. I believe he did something where he had a lot of something similar to having a lot of focus on top speed and saw some good results on their acceleration as well. I'm sure it was a well-balanced program that had components of both. Yeah, so I'll say this. As much as a top speed person as I am, from a practical standpoint, I mean, most well-balanced programs, high school track and field or even collegiate track and field, have an acceleration day, a top speed day, and a speed endurance or special endurance day on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, with Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday being recovery. I mean, that's kind of a basic template. That's what we do in our fall preseason with my team sport athletes. It's 1 day of acceleration, 1 day of top speed, and, you know, 1 day of change of direction, agility, that sort of thing. So as much as a top speed person as I am, don't find the binary this or that argument to be productive. From a, you know, a real world setting standpoint, I think that you need to train all components of it. Clearly, I love the fly 10. Don't get me wrong, but I still think, I mean, you need to train acceleration. You need to train all of it, I think. So
yeah, it's
really long winded answer there.
No, it's great. It's great. You're convincing me, changing my mind a little bit, which is, you know, for my big old thick skull, that takes some work. So this has been very, very enlightening. I look at it, sometimes I feel like these arguments and debates, and I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus for the listeners out here so that they don't get triggered, But it's one of those things where sometimes I think it's a misunderstanding. We're having an argument over something that isn't really an argument, and you kind of laid it out. It's one of those things like you have to accelerate before you run maximum velocity. So you're going to accelerate and then you're going to run maximum velocity. The thing I think that you could argue then, if we're going to make that a reality, like, again, I don't see anybody throwing somebody down a treadmill and then saying, okay, right, run as fast as you can, Roadrunner or Wile E. Coyote. It's not going to happen. And I think what debatable thing is, hey, you get to 20, you get to 30, then you probably, if you really want the value of this, you probably need to take it even farther, as we talked about in a different podcast, if you can, because you may not have the facility to be able to do it. But if you can, there probably isn't a ton of value in terms of overall improvement of absolute speed if we're just shutting things down at 20 to 30. Now, could we be working on, like you said, positions and shapes for acceleration that will allow us to run faster later? Sure. But if we want to try to move the needle on being absolutely fast, faster for that absolute speed and max velocity, then that needs to be something we're seeing in that practice. Like, I don't like to divide up acceleration and max velocity into two separate sessions. I like to do it in the same session. I like to smash it together to provide myself. And it just, the understanding is that that 30 meters or 20 meter buildup is part of that acceleration practice. And then we model that into then maybe saying, okay, we might do some of those. And then we might do some where we do that to a point, and then we do a fly sprint, and then we might do an assisted sprint, you know, and you're constantly changing the inertia and velocity and resistance as you're moving along, you know, and trying to pair those things up. And I look at it as like, when coaches do this stuff where they split it up, they're missing a good meal. So like, if we're only doing acceleration, great. You have your red wine or you have your appetizer. Great. But then you didn't do the max velocity, which is that bloody delicious steak, you know? And then if you don't finish it up with some other like good cool downs, you know, which would be like your dessert to clear the palate, then you're not getting something out of that as well. And so I think when we look at these again, I don't want to say it's because of lack of knowledge or lack of understanding, but it has to be for some people that are making that argument, because they look at the information, they look at the data, and they're like, well, this is the one modality that's superior to all others. Yes, it might be, but without these other modalities, then you're building an imperfect system and you're taking away the ability to then take that part of it farther, faster, higher.
Yeah, I mean, one really good point you said is, I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with combining, you know, like an Excel day and a Max V day. I think the lines are a lot more blurred, of course, than, you know, people might think. We've already touched upon it, but if you're doing a good, you know, fly 10 from 30 to 40, well, that first 30 meters leading up to it has to be a good acceleration, right? Otherwise, you're just not going to get to, you know, a fast speed at 30. Likewise, if you're doing 30 meters, you know, like maybe classic workout for us for Excel would be 10, walk back, 20, 2 minutes recovery, 30, 3 minutes recovery, 10, 20, 30, 10, 20, 30, right? So you're going through that three times. But in those 30s, I mean, for our developmental sprinters at Westchester, I mean, they're at 90 to 95% of top speed by the time they're hitting right. that, you know, that 30 meter mark. So they're certainly touching upon high speed qualities, and you better believe that they're into their upright mechanics by the time they're at 25 meters. So there's probably just more gray area than, you know, I think we all typically like to divide things into. You know, one more side note on that is, especially if I'm in with like team sport athletes on a 2 day a week layout, for whatever reason, one day will be linear and one day will be multi-directional speed. So then in that linear day, we're clearly combining both acceleration and top speed, and that works just great. So many roads lead to Rome. Like many other social media debates, it's interesting but not productive, or you know,
so true.
Very interesting but not always productive, I should say.
But having that argument, I think, allows for smart people such as yourself to then go, okay, hold on. You're missing the forest through the trees on this. you're not quite getting.
It brings up some good discussion points. I would say that, yeah, the prior comment somewhat tongue in cheek, but yeah, it allows for some good discussion points. I think in this format, for example, I mean, it'd be fun to break out those Twitter posts into 10 person Zooms and hash it all out.
It could be fun, you know, for sure. It
or
could
maybe
be.
Get but, ugly. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's the cool thing about this format. I think that what's interesting about what we have going on in terms of our communication as a species right now is very interesting. In one respect, we have like the 260 character folks, you know, and then on the other end, people are really having a thirst and a desire to have these type of conversations, you know, sure. But yet we spend a lot of time on social media, almost to the equalness of the popularity and the rise of popularity of podcasts. So that you see this again, it's almost binary in the way that we have discussions, you know, like some people really want those quippy, quick, spicy, hot takes. And then others really want to have these long form conversations like you and I are having, Doctor. So let me ask you this. If you had your decision, okay, and you were the grand poobah of Westchester, okay, or you were the grand poobah of your favorite professional sports team, how do you think organizations could and should leverage their sports scientists?
Yeah, so another great question. All of them have been good questions tonight. You know, I think professional sports teams, at least in this day and age, it comes down to monitoring for purposes of health and availability. I mean, I'm not sure if that's good or bad, but basically, you know, seeing where people are as far as readiness to train, readiness to play, that sort of thing. That has become key. So, and those are actually areas where, you know, perhaps those are not totally in my wheelhouse as far as some of the, you know, the day-to-day monitoring tools that they're doing, and you know, how they're assessing their athletes and determining, you know, who needs, like in the NBA, to play X many minutes or needs a night off, that sort of thing. I mean, I think when you're dealing with million-dollar athletes, million-dollar commodities to the franchise, that clearly that's where, you know, that's where the biggest decisions need to be made. I think perhaps it's a little bit different at the university level, because then, you know, in my mind, it's a little bit less about like minutes missed or minutes played. And it's more about, you know, truly athletic development. That's why I actually love the small school level, because in a situation where athletes still have a long where they can get better and really, you know, you're interested in trying not just to make sure that they're healthy, of course, but also make big improvements in their athletic performance. Not too many Division III athletes are genetic freaks. So if I had to say, you know, at like a small school level, and that's probably where I can speak more to, since I've spent most of my life there as either an athlete or coach or now professor, I think that there needs to be perhaps better integration of the services that exist. So one of the initiatives that we have at Westchester that I'm really hopeful to get going on in the near future is we've got a great sports med department. We've got a great sports nutrition department. We've got a great kinesiology department, and we're all housed at least temporarily right now in the same building with athletics. We have the potential to do something great as it relates to our student athletes, doing great baseline assessments when they enter in the fall, both of, you know, from a sports med standpoint, from a athletic performance standpoint, from a dietary and nutrition standpoint, giving the athletes and the coaches great feedback, using baseline metrics to monitor return to play in the case of injury, whether it's from hamstring to concussion to ACL and everything in between, and then tracking over a four-year period. If I was the grand poobah of, you know, a small university and was really interested in, you know, seeing big things happen, I would try to get, you know, kind of those four elements working together. And I think we're on the verge of that at Westchester. I would see that as a really cool data tracking and experiment. Hey, let's you know, watch our athletes develop over 4 weeks, 4 months, and 4 years, basically, right? Let's see, you know, how they're going through each training cycle. Let's see how they're progressing over the course of each semester. Let's see, you know, how our athletes are advancing during the course of their college career. I think there's a ton of research possibilities and a ton of, more importantly, possibilities just to benefit our student athletes through the use of sports science in that way. So I think that's perhaps a bigger goal that I have professionally, is really getting that off the ground at Westchester. And I think to the point of your question, I can't really speak to the professional level per se, but you know, at the smaller college and university level, I think there's a ton of possibilities for that to really make a great impact on student athletes' lives over the course of a 4-year career.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I also think, like, in a Division III setting, I think those people might be, as a Division III athlete myself, they might be more open and willing to some of those things, because it's like, hey, yeah, that would be interesting. I felt like there was a gap in my performance, or I feel like I have something left on the table, or maybe I didn't have the best coaching, but here's an opportunity for me to close the gap on maybe somebody who is more of a genetic freak. It's really interesting. And I do believe that you have one of those really cool, unique situations where the coach and the scientist are partners in this process, and using what is at ready, the current best data information, to make some of those decisions as you're providing interventions for these athletes to be great. And that's awesome. And I know you know this, but that's a very unique situation that a lot of other places just don't have.
Yeah, I think it's cool. And you know, as you said, one of the great things about small college athletics that I've always found is that the athletes are, you know, very coachable and, you know, really open to anything they can see that's going to get them a leg up, which makes it an enjoyable environment. So.
For sure. Two more questions. One is, you have so much respect and we love you and we appreciate you spending all this time with us and talking to the audience today and with me. I've learned a lot tonight, which is, hey, a benefit of having these conversations.
It's a two-way street.
I get to learn.
I appreciate that, but it works both ways. But thank you.
Hey, man, I appreciate you. With that, is there, and you've mentioned a lot of sports scientists and researchers out there, is there someone that you would like to scale up or give a shout out to for the work that they're doing that others should be paying attention to? And what is that work that's kind of you respect or you're interested in that they're doing?
Yeah, definitely. I've mentioned his name already. He's a friend and a colleague from a research standpoint is Michal Cahill. I got to know him when I was living down in Dallas and coached with him at Jesuit Prep, and was lucky enough to be a part of his doctoral dissertation, working with athletes, sports science setting there at Jesuit, and on resisted acceleration. And he's kind of moved into the private sector, but in a way in which he's still mentoring students and going to be able to collect research and run research studies in the private sector. So really think that he's doing some great things now. I'm going to mention three other names, actually, if that's okay.
Totally fine.
And I've two buddies, really good friends, Corey Waltz and Jeremy Weeks at University of Pennsylvania. They're the director and assistant director of sports performance there that are, you know, coaches, but also just incredible sports science minds. I mean, they're coaches first. That's what they get paid to do. But both guys have incredible research minds. I've collaborated on research with both guys, and they're both just great friends of mine and great people, and are about to do great things at UPenn. They've only recently taken over there in a full-time capacity within the last 15 months or so. So Michal and Corey and Jeremy. And then lastly, a guy I've been lucky enough to mentor a little bit at Westchester, who's now down at SMU, a guy named Lance Brooks, who, if you have not heard of him yet, you will in a few years. He's a young buck, only about 24, 25, I think, but on the verge of doing some great things from a research standpoint, and kind of the same vein as, you know, everything that's come out of the SMU Locomotor Lab, which is great research, but very applied in nature as well. So probably those four like to give shout outs to. So.
Awesome, man. Well, they're going to appreciate that and getting the word out on them and the work that they're doing, and we'll have opportunities to look at the stuff that they're going to be producing as they move through their career as sports scientists, which is exciting to give us kind of a to narrow down, maybe even for some people, for us to research and look into and stuff like that. I think that's always good for coaches who are really interested in and trying to up their game on the scientific end and try to apply the things that are applicable from that research and that data. So last question, man. You are universally respected as a sports scientist and by sports scientists and coaches alike.
I'm blushing.
So what do you think separates you a bit from others that allows you to have respect in both of those worlds and just be universally beloved by both communities?
Oh, gosh. I need the blushing emoji. You're too kind. You know, I don't know the answer to that question. You know, it's just I appreciate the kind words, and you know, I'm just really lucky to be where I'm at, and you know, I've had a lot of great opportunities along the way, and some great. I come from a great family. I've had some great mentors at Westchester, at SMU, Dave Stern at Westchester, Peter Way and Larry Ryan at SMU, coached with some great people. Corey Mihal, Jeremy, Jason Kilgore, and I think you know you just try to learn from everybody that you know crosses your path and has a good influence on you. And so I don't know, I really don't know. I found a you know I guess a good niche, you could say, kind of in this hybrid world, coaching, researching, and teaching. And I just feel grateful for the people that have had a positive influence on my life and hope to pay that. Hope to pay that forward. So thanks. Not a good answer, but I appreciate the question. So
no problem, Dr. Clark. So where can others and young bucks in the sports science world or coaches that are interested in maximum velocity, speed, resistance, you know, acceleration, training in general, all that kind of stuff, where can they reach you and find you?
Yeah. So on social media, at Ken Clark Speed. I'm not very creative, so I could only think of one social media handle. That's what I'm interested in. So, at Ken Clark Speed, one word. And then, likewise, my website, which was launched about six months ago, kenclarkspeed.com. And, it's just kind of a housing platform for everything, doing research, coaching-wise, some videos on there, that sort of thing. Feel free to reach out to me through those platforms if you have follow-up questions. And, hopefully I can get back to you and provide some extra insight. But these were, I don't know, Ryan, I mean, how many questions did you ask where I was like, well, I don't have a good answer to that. That means the questions were really good. Just motivates further questions here, right? So,
well, you know, hopefully maybe we go back and we look at some of that stuff and it provides you or someone else listening and an avenue or an opportunity to explore and to research. And honesty is better. I much rather talk to somebody who tells me, you know, I just don't know, versus someone who is lock, stock, and barrel, says they got the truth and is an absolutist. In general, those people give me the heebie-jeebies. So honesty is always the best policy. And Dr. Clark, we appreciate you being here and spending all this time and answering all these questions and diving deep into a lot of different topics that I know coaches will find interesting and apply. And the listeners that are here for Companions of the Compendium podcast, really appreciate your time. And if you're listening, please make sure that you spread the word about this podcast out. Subscribe if you can. Give us a review and ranking. Let us know how we're doing. And for sure, be smart, be safe, be kind, make good decisions. We love you guys. Peace out.